outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gen.
Hi, this is Wayne, and before I turn you over to the podcast today, I've got some bad news. We've heard from our friends in Kenya, and the drought there has worsened in the northern regions. There are wildlife dying, cattle, people are starving. They've asked if we could help with some relief work in some of the tribes they're in touch with there, with food for the elderly, for nursing moms, and for orphans. And if you could help us, that'd be great. I'll include a contact at the bottom of the podcast notes. So if you want to help send some money to Lifestream so that we can help them, that'd be awesome. As I promise, every time, every dime you send will actually go to Kenya. We don't take out anything here at Lifestream for our own needs. Please, if you can at this stage in your life, give generously. And if you can't give right now, be in prayer for them, would you? It's a very tough time. Now to the podcast. Well, I guess it's way past time to state the obvious.
And the obvious would be?
The obvious would be that you are and have been for some time the co-host of The God Journey, but we've never said anything about it. You've been guest until you've guested your way right into the co-hosting role, I assume.
I am excited to be formally considered the co-host of The God Journey.
Yeah, tack that to your resume. So that'll be helpful.
I definitely will. It's been, man, I mean, did you even think that we would be sitting here today after, 8-9 months of God Journey guest episodes that we considered the co-host of the God Journey?
No, I thought we've gone going this way for a long time. But, you know, the way this has unfolded, Brad for a long time and then not Brad for a while, and then Brad back in the mix, and then Julie in the mix, you in the mix, some other people in the mix, and then I'm just happy to see where this goes, and it's obvious where it's gone. It's kind of like when I like to say when Paul went and appointed the elders of the churches that he went back to, he wasn't pointing guys that were shocking everybody. He was just kind of pointing out what was already true, except for those who were claiming to be and weren't. That he had to make clear. No, you're not really an elder. You keep trying to be. But I like that it's kind of emerged this way, and it's kind of just happened in the course of what we've done together, and I think that's fun. So Kyle Rice, who's the president and CEO of Blue Sheet Media, maybe, are you?
I would say co-founder with my wife of Blue Sheet Media.
Yeah, and I got emailed just this morning, as a matter of fact. Said, would somebody explain to me what blue sheep are? So maybe it's a good time.
Really?
We did it once on the podcast. That's probably like 2 years ago now. So,
okay.
What are blue sheep?
Yeah, so blue sheep actually came from a conversation that my wife and her sister were having. And they were just talking about Jess and who she is as a person. She was talking about how Jess is a person who loves people well, who's a little different, a little out there, who hasn't followed a normal journey, and yet she's been very true and very authentic to herself. And Jess's sister said, well, you're a blue sheep. And Jess was like, wait a minute, what do you mean a blue sheep? Come to find out, it's actually a Scottish term where you have the people who are the quote-unquote white sheep, who are the people who kind of follow the rules and go with the norm and are following in the herd. And then you have the people who are considered more the black sheep, who are the intentional rebellious, like I'm operating out of pain and I just want to go against the system. And they're moving out of this place of anger or hurt or whatever it may be. And so there's that black sheep, but then there's the blue sheep, who are people who are a little different, a little out there, but genuinely want to live an authentic life and live authentically for who they are. And as we were talking about, we were really wrestling with, okay, what do we call this publishing company? But even more than that, what really defines who Jess and I are as people and as a couple? And not only do we both not feel like we're necessarily a white sheep or a black sheep, but just have a genuine desire to live from who God has created us to be, but also to encourage other people in that journey, to feature and support other people who are in that journey. And we found ourselves kind of in a flock of blue sheep and just love the fact that, man, there's this cool term and this cool idea out there of being a quote-unquote blue sheep, of somebody who is true to who God created them to be, who's wanting to live authentically and to move in that space and see what God has to do with that.
Cool. That's like a lot of God Journey folks, huh?
Just absolutely
don't always fit into the conventions, but aren't out there just being rebellious and destructive, finding a way to be authentic to the journey God's given you and how to live in Him. So I think that's pretty cool. You also do a lot of life coaching and mental health work. And it's been fun watching the email over the last year change from, oh, I really miss Brad, which I hear you, I do too, to, well, I really appreciate what Kyle adds to the podcast. So that's been growing and been fun to have you. So yeah, official co-host of The God Journey. I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I am the official co-host of The God Journey, Kyle Rice.
Oh, welcome. In fact, we're working on a new book with Jess and Blue Sheep. It's the second book in the Velieri series that Tessa Van Wade is doing. I have to remember her name because that's not what they called her growing up. But Tessa Van Wade is doing it. If you haven't read the first one, which is Out of the Shadows, let me encourage you to read it. If for no other, I mean, it's a thriller kind of chase, high drama activity kind of a thing. But read it for the second one. The second one does the best I've ever read of drilling down into how we mentally get attacked and pulled away from who we really are and how it is that we have to learn to think inside what God thinks of us rather than what we think or what other people try to define us as. And it doesn't say it in those terms because it's really just a great thriller story. But man, I was going through some tough sledding this summer. And I was reading that book to Sarah while we were on a trip to Denver and back. And man, there were so many phrases, so many insights, so many things that are exactly paralleling what was going on in my life at that moment. It's coming out in June. So if you haven't read the first one yet, now's a good time to order up Out of the Shadows and give it a shot.
I mean, the first one was phenomenal. You know, it set the stage. It kind of had, you weren't exactly sure where the book was going as far as like, okay, is this a psychological thriller? Is this a spiritual thriller? Like what kind of book is this, sci-fi? Like, what kind of book is this? I remember having conversations with Jess, even trying to categorize it because it brings in so many different unique elements. But then as the second book merges into that conversation about, man, how that mind game, which is so powerful, especially even with some of the things that we're going to be talking about today, I think they segue a lot with some of the themes and some of the ideas that Tessa's really pulling out in that book in a fictional way versus a non-fictional way. And I can't wait for the third one too, to see, okay, what's going to happen? Like, where is she going to take this? How is it going to finish out?
Let's not get people excited about the third one until they've at least had a chance to look at the second one, like you and I have.
Oh, they definitely got it. I mean, it's phenomenal. I love the work that she's doing with it. She's created a powerful story that I think really creates a unique take on it. But also, it's one of those books that slips around the guards, and all of a sudden I find myself being like, ooh, that's touching some heart stuff. That's bringing some real reality stuff to the surface that I didn't know was still back in there that needed to come out.
Can't wait to let all that be shared with you. Just trying to warn you, though, if you haven't read the first one yet, get in line so you're ready for June. Hey, have you heard of The Coming Storm?
The Coming Storm? I have not heard of The Coming Storm.
Yeah, my friends from Ireland turned me on to this. It's a podcast, The Coming Storm. It's a BBC look at how did January 6th, 2021 happen?
Ooh, interesting.
And they go all the way back to the 90s with the Clintons and the whole dossier about Donald Trump and how both sides have been warring with misinformation so long and how QAnon got started. I mean, it is a breathtaking journalist view by the BBC that's interesting. I'm 5 episodes in. I think there's only 7, so I've only got 2 to finish.
Okay. But
man, it has just... You know, one of those things where he just kind of draws lines between things. You're going, well, how did that happen? And, you know, how did some idiot, QAnon, how did that guy become so influential? This explains it all, exactly how it unfolded and where it came from and why so many people who I would consider close friends and whatever, how did they get sucked into thinking that a march on the Capitol was a good idea to save the Republic and why they really thought the future of the Republic was at stake? And how powerful a lie is, how powerful lies sewn in with some truth. There's always some truth inside a good lie. A good lie just isn't a lie out of the blue.
Yeah.
Or people go, what? That's impossible. But it's amazing. If you haven't heard it, I think you want to hear it. I think people who care about those kinds of things will want to hear the power of this misinformation and the coming storm and traces back over a long period. And both political parties are guilty of fomenting the environment that caused all this to happen.
I'm super intrigued to read it or to listen to it, especially in context to, you know, the book Jesus and John Wayne that you and I've talked about a little bit. That for me was
That drew some lines too, didn't it?
Yes, it really drew some lines that I hadn't really processed or even thought about, even though there was that inkling, you know, that inkling in your heart of there's something wrong here. There's something off here. And I don't know how. I don't know how we landed here. I don't know how we got there, but I'd love to explore it. And so, I mean, that book did it was a good job, but a challenging job of looking at that and drawing different lines and themes out of the evangelical history, especially more modern history.
Yeah, I finished that book too, finally. And I tell you, as much as I liked some of what she unpacks, and agree with her a lot, the longer it went on, it just seems more like an edginess, I think it would be hard for people who don't already agree with her to read that book and see through it, because they'll kind of feel like she's just piling on them. And in some ways she is, but that didn't discount that a lot of what she says is true, and how evangelicals got sucked into a political way of thinking that actually disfigures the God they claim to serve. I think that part's really true.
I would agree with you that by the end of the book, I felt a little beat up, honestly, of like, ooh, okay. I think you made your point. But I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure where you're standing here. But I think you're right. There was some really good questions that needed to be wrestled with, and some unveiling of just the history and the process and the relationships of how Christians and modern Christians today have interacted with politics, and how we even landed in some of the places that a lot of evangelical Christians found themselves landing in the last decade.
Yeah. And even if you're one of those, and this is a tough read for you, I think it's always good to be exposed to the way other people see us. So it would be great. Yeah. I hope a lot of my friends will read it, but I promise you, I think some of them are too scared to read it.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
In a world of bias confirmation, I'll only want to read things that cheer me along. That's all I want to read. Instead of, let's read something challenging. Makes me think.
So have you had anything else that's made you think this week? Did you have a best thing that I heard this week, Wayne?
Oh my gosh, I did, but it wasn't like a profound quote. It was just, I got an email early in the week, just said, Wayne, you wrote an article somewhere about you have not passed this way before. I'd like to find it. Where can you find it? I was thinking, that's a great phrase. Not passed this way before. So but I don't recall writing anything on it. It sounds really similar to at least what the person was asking about to the podcast I did with Jeff Andreessen about going beyond the maps and what do you do when you're exploring beyond the comfortable stuff? But this phrase, you've not passed this way before. And then the prayer team that I meet with on Wednesday sometimes, that exact phrase came up from someone else.
Really?
As we were praying, just felt like you've not passed this way before. And it was kind of like a little knock on the head. Like, are you hearing this, boy? And I'm like, whoa. And we talked about it for a little bit. We talked about what does it mean that we haven't walked this way before? And it would mean, one, don't trust the conventions that have got you here. Because now, you know, we did the out of the maps thing. But I think I for the last 30 years have been kind of off the trail from which I began into what I consider a much richer life in Christ and life in the body of Christ and church and all those things. So I feel like, well, yeah, I've been on that. And now it's like, no. This is another turn. You're on a different journey than you haven't been this way before, which means, wow, I need to really listen to the guide. This is not, I'm going to trust the landmarks and the things I've used in the past. I really need to look at something else. And it was more than just for me. It was for a number of us. So not to be afraid of the unfamiliar. And then one thing we talked about is not be distracted by nostalgia.
Ooh.
Yeah, if you have not passed this way before, don't keep looking back on, oh, I miss the good old days of this or that or the other thing, because you've not passed this way before, and this is something God's inviting you to. And it's really enlivened my heart over the last few days. I've really been, I'm just going, well, that's a weird thing, because like, I didn't hear God speak that to me. It was like that little treasure hunt thing where I'm going to ding you over here, and I'm going to ding you here, and you're going, whoa, hey, that is something coming out of my own heart as to what God's showing me. Love that.
Where do you find yourself, especially as you say that you're moving into a space that you haven't been before? And, you know, I know that there's some things that you're working on. There's been some really challenging stuff with some relationships in your family. You've had some stuff with, you know, having a good friend just recently pass, a longtime mentor and friend and sojourner in this journey. What would you say has highlighted that this is a place that you haven't passed before versus the journey that you've been on over the last 25, 30 years?
I don't know that I can answer that, because I think it's kind of not so much, hey, recognize this is, you have not been here before, but where we're going, you have not been before. So I'm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not like I suddenly woke up and looking around and said, "There's nothing familiar here."
Yeah,
but there has been a lot that's maneuvered my heart into different space over the last, I would say, 2 years, starting 2.5, mm-hmm. starting with a word. Someone had a dream about me and sent me this thing, and I went, "Oh my gosh, there's probably something in that." It's been that. It's been a series of things where God's just really kind of changed my heart, but I still negotiate that the way I do everything else. I mean, this is the way God's led me. And, you know, sometimes we kind of settle in for patterns of behavior that have served us well mm-hmm. and stop listening to the guide. And I don't know that I've stopped listening to the guide. I just think now there's more of a, I want to keep my eye a little closer to the guide, because it's easy to navigate things based on the way I've been learning to navigate them for the last 25 years. And I think all of us, we kind of get more comfortable in process than we do mm-hmm. voice and leading. And so it's kind of back to, I'm going to keep an eye on that. I'm going to see what unfolds here. And I'm not going to make conclusions based on the way I would have made conclusions in the past. So I think it's all prep stuff rather than
yeah.
I'm there now.
Do you think some of that, what you just highlighted, is part of the nostalgia, like the looking back or the judging the new space that you're moving into by the familiar or what you've been through in the past? Do you think that's part of what you mean by or sense by nostalgia?
It could be that. Sure. I think it's always, and I've not looked back for a long time. I don't got things back that I'd like to recapture, re-explore. Mm-hmm. I think that was more for others in the room who maybe have an affinity for nostalgia. I'm not a nostalgic person. I don't think I've always kind of had my eye down the road. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that's for me, but it is, maybe that stuff's more just in family, in immediate family, getting comfortable in relationship, wanting them to be what they were.
Yeah.
Even with my grandkids, that's been changing. They're getting older. Grandma and grandpa aren't, it's not like having a 5-year-old over here who adores everything you do and say. It's now 17, 14, 11-year-olds just kind of, they still love us. Oh my gosh, they do. And then Sarah's been talking about moving. So mm-hmm. there's an unsettledness in the air that could encompass a number of things. Not moving far away, just the house and grounds we live on, a little extensive. Sarah's tired of caring for it. So it's probably that kind of a move. But that just kind of unsettles everything, right? In a really good way. I don't see unsettling at all as, oh my gosh, we're going to this time of uncertainty. I don't. I'm actually excited about what mm-hmm. may unfold in this season. But now I'm going to keep my eye a little tighter on the guide and not trust, oh, I know how to handle this.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't. Maybe the way I handled this before isn't the best way to handle it now.
Man, I can definitely resonate with that feeling of a bit of the unsettledness, or I wouldn't necessarily say restlessness, because I think that it's more of a, okay, I'm sensing some of these things are coming, but I have no idea what it's going to look like. Jess and I have been holding a potential relocation in our hands. We've been looking at some career shift stuff and been holding that in our hands. We've got baby number 2, which is going to be here in about 6 weeks. And so we're holding that in our hands and just saying like, okay, Lord, like there's a whole lot of, in some regards, uncertainty, but unknown that's just kind of lingering there. And so how do I hold space for that? How do I just sit here with that? There's excitement in my heart. There's also a little bit of like, okay, Lord, like, you know, you're going to have to come through in this, right? Because if you don't, then there's no way that's going to happen. Because I told a good friend of mine the other day, I was like, you know, like if I could have my way, these would be the things that would be the reality. And so I listed off like, you know, being full-time into some other things. So being full-time in more of the self-employed outreach, life coaching, some of those things. And baby and a potential relocation to a specific location in the country. And I told a friend of mine that, and he's like, well, so you're talking a major career change, a major geographical relocation, and being the parent of 2 of a newborn. That sounds crazy. I was like, yeah, dude, it is. It absolutely is. And I have no idea what or how God would bring about those things or what that would even look like. But this word uncertainty is an intriguing one. I want to kind of shift a little bit, because you put me onto a new resource that I have just been diving into. I've been talking with some of my students. I've been talking with some of my life coaching clients on. And so the title of it is The State of Religion and Young People, Navigating Uncertainty. And so it was put out by Spring Tides Research Institute, and that ties back to Josh Packard and the work that he's done. He was at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Boulder, no, he was in Fort Collins. So University of Northern Colorado, yeah. University of Northern Colorado, I think. I don't know. Those of you might remember, he was on the podcast with us. He wrote the book Church Refugees, and we talked about some of the spilling out of all that. So yeah, old friend Josh Packard's now with Spring Tide Research. Did this book, the cover caught my eye. I have a friend that kind of turned me on to. I'm not following what Springtime is doing because I know a lot of these resources are kind of designed for the congregational crowd to try and get them to not lose the people they're losing.
Yeah.
The two words on the front in brilliant white letters, navigating uncertainty. Man, that captures me. I'm like, because that's what we felt in the retreat we were with before. I've been feeling like this whole year with the pandemic and the tensions in our world, all kinds of things, the inflation rate, climate change, we are approaching an amazing time of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And I have a theme in what I've shared with a lot of people over the last 5 years probably is the more comfortable we get in God's love, the freer we are to navigate uncertainty. Because we don't need certainty in our circumstances. We have it inside of Him. It's that He will guide us through whatever comes. So now I'm not having to manage what comes or fear what comes or waste anxiety on what comes. Navigating uncertainty, I think, is just the call of the Spirit. And to see it on the cover of a book about young people and religion in America, I went, wow, they hit it. They hit the mother lode right there. Because I think the most important tool all of us need to have right now, whether young or old, is do you have the security in the Father's affection to navigate uncertainty? And if you don't, it's going to really warp your life because you're going to grasp at everything else to try to address that need for certainty. We've already discovered through some of the things we've talked about in last year, even how much certainty is the bent of everyone. Even if they find something false that makes them feel certain, they'll grab it and hold on to it as long as they can believe the illusion. And then when they're disillusioned, then they've got to find something else to grasp for security. And I just think this really hits on the head what God's saying today about where He's inviting His people to come. Come live in my love enough that you don't need certainty in your circumstances because you found it in me. It's still, we still have a quest for certainty, but let's find it in the character and activity of God instead of finding it in the circumstances of my life.
It reminds me of a conversation that I had with a client just a little bit ago about this exact topic. We were literally talking about this and exploring and trying to navigate certainty and how they've handled the coronavirus, how they've handled the pandemic, and some of the other things that are going on in their life. And that was the comment that we talked about is like, okay, there is a consistency in the love of the Father that surpasses circumstances, that surpasses geographical location, that surpasses all of these different things that we try to lean into for that certainty. And yet there's only one consistent, is that conversational relational love with the Father that cannot be stolen, that cannot be taken away, that no matter how far you are, that love continues to remain consistent and to pursue your heart. And yet, man, there are so many counterfeits out there. It's really intriguing. I mean, that we were listing off several different things that were potential counterfeits or things that could be drawing this individual's attention. And I mean, they've gone down several different roads and we're circling back. We're like, no, I think there's something here. I think there's this love in the Father. And yet they were, one of the biggest things that they were wrestling with is religion. And specifically Christianity, and them feeling like, wait a minute, I've grown up in this environment, I've had these different ideas, I've had these experiences, and yet all of a sudden, the people I'm watching the pandemic happen, and I'm watching people who I've known were in quote unquote leadership positions in churches or had significant positions or whatever, and they're just falling apart. There isn't grace, there isn't a sense of rest, there isn't a sense of peace. And that really comes back to some of the research that Josh Packard and the team found, is that very few of them went to very few of the people that were polled actually went to a spiritual leader during the pandemic for support.
or what they call a religious leader. They use religion correct. In this book, unlike the way we use it on God Journey. We ran into that with Josh and we talked about church, because church sociological work is a very defined term, right? And so is so is religion. But he's just talking about these people with uncertainty, and young people especially, the church is not their answer. And I don't think it's been the answer for my generation either, but it kept saying it was the certainty of religious leaders, the certainty of the institution we're involved in, but those split and change and leadership fights and the betrayal and lies and gossip. And then you think there's certainty in family. Then you find out, no, there's not necessarily certainty in family. That's a problem. And then there's certainty in the scriptures, but then you interpret scriptures in a way that provoke people's fears about politically things that were happening, and many saw Donald Trump as a messiah. And it's no wonder that this younger generation is going, hey, there's no answers for me over there. And this book is really about how to turn that around, because we want them to find their answers in our religious institutions. And I don't think that's the answer from this book, but I think it diagnoses the problem so well that there's to find out that the spiritual hunger underlying not just young people, but even older people around you, is that quest for certainty in something. And the fact that their illusions of certainty are falling apart. Like when the pandemic started, so many Christians were Psalm 91 or whatever it was, that the affliction shall not come nigh the tent of the righteous. That was their certainty until they got COVID. Their friends got COVID. Their children got COVID. And then it was, oh my gosh, if that's not certain. And it's not that the words of God are not certain, they are, but we have misinterpreted those words to our own amusement. That's not what's true. It's our interpretation of those words. Oh, well, that means if I'm really following God, I'm not going to have any trouble. And it's been a constant set of, I think, Christians in fear for their salvation, in fear for the political realities in the United States, in fear for whatever, are so easily manipulated. The coming storm, that podcast we talk about, it'll talk about that. And I'll link it here at the bottom of the podcast so if others want to hear it. But there's really a sense of what I thought I could find certainty in has failed me. And that's true for a lot of people. But man, there's no better time for the gospel, a real gospel, to penetrate the world and find that you have a certainty in God that's incredible, but it's not like the certainty you think you're seeking. It's not that. It's like Israel, right? It's the same thing as Israel. There's the invisible God here. He's got a cloud above him by day, fire by night. He's feeding them manna every day, but they can't find a way to trust that. How do we get food? How do we do this? We can't fight those enemies. I think the same dilemma is true post-Christ, post the cross. We believe all these things about God and then don't live it in a way that makes it real. And then we get disillusioned with scripture or with God, and we turn our back on all that stuff. And so it's no wonder these people are going, I'm not going to look over there for this answer, not with that religious crowd. But I'm telling you, the answer is in God if it's not in the religious crowd, which it's not.
And I think the way that all of this is oriented and the way that going about even encountering that love or sharing that love with others, I was talking with an individual about witnessing. And what does witnessing look like? And they were talking about a relationship with an individual that's a part of their life, a close part of their life. And I said, okay, so if you were going to witness to them, what would you change? And they just kind of paused and they're like, well, I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't change the way that I'm living out my life alongside of them and the way that I'm encouraging them and the way that I'm sharing, authentically sharing what I'm doing in the world and how I'm doing it in the world, which I just loved. Because when I was told about witnessing, when I was coached in what it looked like to be witnessing, I mean, the person was, you identified your target, you went after them, you had the Roman road, like you looked for that intentional conversation where then you could just slam them with the Roman road and bring them to salvation. It's like, whoa, like there's no way, A, I would want somebody to do that to me, let alone me do that to somebody else. So one of the quotes in the book that really stood out to me, and I would love your thoughts on this, that it said that 58% of polled young adults between the ages of 13 and 25 said that I do not like to be told answers about faith and or religion. I'd rather discover my own answers. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, see, I love that so much. But that's exactly the opposite of what you just said about evangelism. We were taught to just take these answers we have, put them in a plunger, and force it down their throat as fast as we can. And eventually just get them to concede so we can save their soul and go on to the next one. Because I think it's always been true in God's eyes that he wants to invite us into a reality that's greater than any institution can control. How Jesus comes alive in people is very different than here are the answers, follow them. Because then that just becomes the legalistic, here's what you have to believe, here's how you have to practice it, here's what you need to do. And people just get caught in that. And it leads to the kind of emptiness I hear. I've got a letter I put on the blog probably this week from a guy who 25 years gave up on that, was a leader in a faith community, gave up on that 25 years. And then through some amazing circumstances, God reintroduced himself to this man in a way that's just so beautiful. And I love those stories. And I think that we want to celebrate that happening with young people, but we don't. What happens when a Christian parent sees their child in their mid to late teens start asking questions that they never asked themselves because they grew up, got the answers, stayed with the answers, even if they didn't work kind of thing? It really makes people nervous when people go, I don't want you to give me the answer. What? What? No, that's what we do. We give answers instead of, no, we come alongside and see what God's revealing and cheerlead for that part of it that seems godly and take some restraint, you know, from trying to force your answers in on them till they come to a place of discovery. And then when they're ready, they'll ask you. You don't have to sneak the answer in there. That's good advice, not just for young people. That's good advice for older folks too.
So why do you think that there's such that strong innate drive to get that answer in, or to, you know, to force that certainty, or to get that statement in there, that understanding or that knowledge or that wisdom in there to that young person? That's like the example that you gave of a parent seeing a teen that's really questioning and really wrestling. What is the temptation, or what drives that temptation or that motivation to get that answer in there right away?
I think it's the false certainty. We have the false certainty of our answers are right. If you just believe the right thing, you'll be okay. And from God's side of it is, I don't want you just to believe the right thing. I want you to discover something real that changes your heart. We've settled for it probably for the last 1900 years. We've settled for elders being guardians of right faith and practice. We decide what you should believe and do. You believe and do it. We found security in that. And that fear that, if my child questions it, I think that's part of the problem too. If my child questions his faith, I don't even question this faith because it's on thin ice with me. If I think about it too much, there's lots of questions I can't answer and things I don't know. And I'm just hoping to get my get out of hell free card. That's why people who fear hell are a danger in the world, not only for themselves, but for other people. Because I say, if you don't get the right answer here, I'll never see you again. And you'll die and go to hell. And it's all that anxiety that comes out that's completely counterproductive to whatever it is that you want to happen in the heart of a person, a young person, a child that you love. You want them questioning. You want them exploring. You want to trust that God is big enough to make himself known. And rather than try to force it to happen, be alongside it as it happens. It's not that there's not value to people down the road from me and they can help me see things I'm not seeing, but that comes best in my time, right? Not in their time of, I've got this to teach you. And we've had a whole generation of Christians. How have we done this stuff? By going to seminars and reading self-help books and learning the answers and trying to implement the answers. And then when the answers don't work, we don't admit it. We just keep going in the deadness and just feel, I'm going through a dry time. I know people have been going through dry times for 40 years. There's got to be a point where you're saying, what I'm doing isn't working. And if we're afraid it's not working, then our only hope is that the answers are right, even if they don't work. And then that's what makes us afraid when we see somebody younger wanting to discover and then us becoming the impediment to that discovery.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting challenge. And I think, honestly, I would see that the questions that a lot of the younger generation are, and I find this in my work, that some of the questions that I get posed in sessions, it's like, ooh, I've got two roads that I can go down this. I can either react in fear or defensiveness of my ideas that I have, or I can view their question as an invitation to explore alongside of them and say, well, actually, I'm not sure. Let's explore that. Let's dive into that. What's going on in your heart? What's going on in my heart? And let's see what's happening here. Because I think that's so often exactly what you said, where there, when a question comes up, that's triggering your own fear, your own lack of really wrestling through it and trying to find those answers or wrestling through those hard spaces. And so to, you know, and yet, man, that the young people of today, like they're, I would say that they're giving or offering this invitation of it's time to take a look at it. Like I literally was I was watching the documentary called The Heretic. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's about Rob Bell and his life. And one of the interviewers in that interview said that that religion needs you to fear hell in order to be able to modify your behavior. And so then, and they were talking about Rob Bell's book, Love Wins, and how he posed a question about the necessity to fear hell. And as a result, there was just this absolute uproar, explosion, death threats, etc. When whatever you feel about Rob Bell, what I loved about it was that he posed a question about a long-held belief and said, let's explore this. I want to wrestle with this. Let's discover together what actually might be here. And instead, they tried to crucify him for it and literally ran him out of Michigan for it.
Well, part of that too. I mean, let's get away from Rob Bell, because I think Rob Bell, he right loves wins, but he had an agenda. He's asking a question, but it's not an open question.
Correct.
Yes. He's trying to manipulate to an answer. I often say that to people, though. What would our Christianity look like if it wasn't based in fear? If it was based in trust?
Yes.
Now, you don't have to have an agenda behind that other than to say you can't come alongside someone and help them if you're afraid for them. Because you will manipulate them. It goes back to Dave Coleman, one of Dave Coleman's things. It goes back to you become a manipulator. And I think those questions, as I read Love Wins, knowing where he was going, he's posing questions with an agenda behind them. So I think that's what ticked people off. When fear is the only thing holding you safe in your mind, then you will hold on to it with the tenacity of a Rottweiler on a bone, man. You are not going to let go of that thing. And I think that's, most people wouldn't do religion if their fear of hell wasn't in play. That's going through Dante's Divine Comedy. That's the deal of the Roman Catholic Church, right? When you're going to practice religion as your answer for humanity, you've got to get people in it by threatening them with something worse. Mm-hmm. And I think the only thing worse than religious practice is hell. That's what keeps people in it. So if you take that away, are people going to stay? Most of them are not. But there's such a better reason to follow God. There really is.
And that's been a reoccurring theme that I've been hearing over just the last couple of months that I've been really wrestling with in my own journey. Is I've been hearing it come out in my client story or client stories. Is this actually a life worth living? Like, why are you doing what you're doing? Because if you're saying that you're doing X, Y, and Z in regards to, you know, whether it be religious performance or academic performance or whatever, like, but really looking at that performance of I'm going to make something happen, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z in order to be able to gain whatever life. And yet, man, especially in the context of Christianity, where when they start talking about this to-do list, and yet I keep, Wayne, I can't tell you how deeply I keep hearing the song of the older brother coming up, especially in people who are like in the millennial or late iGen, like that really had some stuff with religion or with Christian, like a conservative Christian background. And yet they're like that song of the older brother of like, man, I want to do what's right. And yet my heart goes out to them because it's like, why do you want to do what's right? Is it because you find life in Christ? Because I hear, like, I literally listened to a sermon this weekend, and I just listened to the recording of it, and the person was going through the laws of, like, God's rules and how life is to be found in God's rules. And I was like, well, like, okay, but are you actually finding life there? And what, like, I don't do the things that God is asking Jess and I to do or myself to do because it's a rule. I see it as a relational invitation. I've found when I walk into the things that he invites me into, I find more life, more freedom, more love, more wholeheartedness there instead of going against it.
Yeah, and when you follow rules, you don't find more life there. The way I think people honestly answer that, are you finding life there, you rule teacher? And they're going, well, I find my income there. If they were really honest, that's what it is. Because most of them, when they leave that, they don't continue the same practice. They don't. Yeah. It's something. It's like the guy that can't sell flipped houses, so he does infomercials about flipping houses. Because that's how he makes his money. He doesn't make them flipping houses. He makes money telling you how you could do it and make money, whether you do. And most people who try it don't, because it just doesn't work. And I think that's so endemic to this religious kind of approach to things. If you think life is in the rules, you have to have missed the whole New Testament. And instead of admitting we missed that, we turned the New Testament into another set of rules.
Yes.
And substituted that for the life of Christ. The promise comes through faith. The promise doesn't come through performance, obedience, conformity. Obedience is the fruit of the promise taking root in our hearts. Now I'm going to obey God, not because I'm following the rules, for Pete's sakes. That's the whole, I think, uptake of the Sermon on the Mount. It's not you can get here by performance, because you read it going, I can never get there. Not that way.
Yeah.
But if the changed heart begins to negotiate life inside the reality of who God is and how he makes himself known in the world, now we've got a hope at watching that transformation happen. And if I don't trust that it's happening in me, if I've got to do all the work to make me change, that's why they can't let someone else discover what changes for them. Hmm. Their trust, their certainty is in their rules. And there's no life in the rules. I think, I know how many people tell me, the scriptures about your joy being full, you have abundant life. And people have thought, well, that means I'll have a big home, nice car, great job, you know, healthy, and that kid's never be sick, blah, blah, blah. And then find out, oh, that's not true. So what abundance is there if that's not what it is? And I think the greatest indicator in our heart of if our journey is working, it was that we're finding fullness of joy in dire situations, that we're finding peace when I'm at risk. It's not I'm at peace because everything in my life is great.
Yeah.
It's because God's bigger than the stuff going on in my life. And I think those were indicators. When you get to the Upper Room Discourse, Jesus is giving us indicators. My joy in you, you're joyful. Life and life abundantly. Ask whatever you want in my name. It will be given to you. And he's saying some pretty definitive realities that most Christians are like, it doesn't work. I tried it, man. I asked God to heal my wife dying of cancer. He didn't do it. So then they discount the words of Jesus rather than going back and saying, maybe our process is flawed. Mm. If what I'm doing doesn't lead me to that, then what I'm doing needs to be reexamined. And maybe I find something freer to walk in. Well, I'm going to have to break it off right there. We kept going and going and going. In fact, a whole other podcast worth, which will air next week. And this one is more on how, if you're a caring person that wants to help people at this stages of their journey through uncertainty, how might you do that? And we'll talk about that more next week. Next weekend as well, I'm going to be in Nashville. So if you're around the Nashville area, check out the website. Come join me. Love to see you there. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.